Everything I know about war, I see in Shira's face as she arrives and kisses me 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times, this cheek, then that. Salaam alaikum, how are you? I'm fine. Wrenched to this winter, widowed after 2 decades of invasion, she gets here early for the food. White bread, tomatoes, chili, cheese, digestives, supermarket hummus, or homemade halva, pistachios and spices, a plate of Burmese noodles. Everything I know is in the faces of these women, even when they smile, in their generosity, in places language cannot reach.
I am Dr. Salaam Ismail. I'm an Iraqi doctor. I was chief of junior doctors in Iraq 1.5 years after the war. And I actually came here to UK after the first siege to be eyewitness account on what's happened in Fallujah. It was 2 days before the siege, to be complete on Fallujah in the last March. And I saw on Al Jazeera some scenes, bombing of the areas in Fallujah and people instantly killed, women and children. It's the same thing, the same pictures came to my mind before, during the invasion of Baghdad, during the occupation of Iraq, and how we spent 45 days inside the hospital trying to treat people and seeing all these scenes of bombing, of shells and pieces of the limbs, we have to fix it and all these things. It's horrible. And I saw the same pictures, so I realized that we have to do something. And my family was outside the house, and they are teachers. I'm the only son in my family. So I wrote them a letter that I have to go because it's for my country this time. And until now, they have this letter with them. And I paid a lot of money to enter through the desert to Fallujah, and I entered Fallujah and one day before the siege. And I saw the same scenes of the war. Shooting bombs everywhere, tanks and all these things. They cut the main bridge to the hospital. So I tried to go to the hospital directly, to the main hospital on the other bank of Fallujah City. But they didn't let us go there, the American soldiers. With us, some patients, they said to us, go back, go back. And we refused. We showed them our identity, as we are doctors. And they said, no, go back, go back. And then we turned back, and we have tried to establish field clinics inside the city. We established this, and we continue working inside the field clinic, but with difficult circumstances. So difficult circumstances. And in these field clinics, we have to make theater rooms because we receive patients who need operations. But we tried many times to go to the main hospital to evacuate the anesthesia drugs, anesthesia trolleys, and anesthesia instruments, and the orthopedic instruments, but they refused to. And we enforced to work on amputation with local anesthesia. Amputation, you can imagine, with local anesthesia. We have no antibiotic, and there's spread of Pseudomonas infection inside the theater room, and we cannot do anything. And the suffering continued day by day. I remember the third day of the siege. We called it the bombing day, or the cluster bombs day. Because at that night, it was a horrible night. We continued receiving patients and patients who died, casualty of cluster bombs. Because the American, they tried to enter Jolani Quarter, and they have to swap all the area with cluster bombs before enter it. So that's why many casualties at that day. I faced 25 persons in one family just disappear in one cluster bomb. And we have to carry the bodies. We have to fix the limbs with the heads, with the bodies, and all these scenes. And at the same time, I just remember also another story, which is in the fifth day of the siege. They called us in one night that there is a family trapped inside the sniping area. We call it the ghost area because all the American snipers there. They told us we have to go there. and everyone is scared. So my junior doctor who died in this siege, he took the ambulance with me in that siege, and we go to the area of the ghost area. We entered, we were scared so much, but we have to do it. We are 30 meters from the car, and there is fire in the car. It's newly attacked by missile. Three women in the back seat of the car shouting, and from the missile all the doors are locked up, and there is a child, I think about 4 or 5 years old, on the front bonnet of the car and just moving, and he's the fire in him and the fire also in the woman, and they are shouting, but this child, he cannot shout, he's just moving on the front bonnet. I just remember this scene every day. It's a night like nightmare. And we opened the door of the ambulance trying to go and extinguish the fire, but the American sniper shot us and preventing us from going there. And we just closed the door of the ambulance, just crying, and we saw them until they became charcoal. It was the 8th day of siege, and we ran out of food inside the hospital. We have to use the sugar, eat it every time to keep it working. But some of the aid entered the city, and we have delivered to the families trapped inside the sniping area. So we take the ambulance, open the side door, we start to throw the bread inside the houses, and we carry in containers. And whenever we put the container of water, filled with water, in the street, we cannot put a step outside the street because we will be sniped. Whenever we put the container on the street, the American sniper shot the container, prevent the water from going inside to the families. This is the human rights inside Fallujah. We faced from occupation many things. My house had been attacked 4 times. They arrest my father, he's 64 years old. They arrest him for 8 hours. And they put the gun in his head. And they told him, shoot yourself. It's better for you in front of... And start humiliating him in front of my 2 sisters, young sisters. And they are shouting. And this happened every day. And this cycle will continue. And you cannot enforce peace by force. Never, ever.
The thing with Fallujah was we were in Baghdad, and a doctor friend, Dr. Salam, had come out of Fallujah. His ambulance had been shot at. The one in front had been hit by a missile. And people were telling us that the ambulances weren't able to move around. Medical supplies and aid convoys weren't able to get into the town. And that ambulances were being shot at, and civilians trying to leave the town were stuck at the checkpoints, not being let through. So they asked if we would try and get some medical supplies in, thinking that as foreigners we might be let through the checkpoints. And we were, so we took in the medical supplies, and they asked if anyone was willing to escort the ambulances in the US-held areas. So we did. When it got dark, we were trying to pick up a woman that was in premature labour, and our ambulance was shot at by the Marines because they didn't see that we were foreigners, so they just treated us like they do the Iraqis.
And describing this experience, because you've written extensively on the internet, I mean, the bullet came very close to you, didn't it?
I didn't actually realise how close until... there was some people that had filmed the ambulance, and they'd filmed it before we went out, and they'd filmed it after we came back. And there were actually 2 bullets that came relatively close to where I was sitting, but I didn't know that at the time. So, but they were tracer bullets, so you could see them zipping past the window.
Obviously, you're putting yourself, though, in very dangerous positions.
Well, but the thing is, it was a lot less dangerous for us than it was for the Iraqis. You know, there were people bleeding and people in premature labour without medical help and all that kind of thing. And the only people that had a chance of moving around the city were us, because we were foreign. So, yeah, it was dangerous.
And what was your perspective on the Mujahideen fighters that you met?
Well, I mean, the fighters that we met were all local people. They were all people that lived in Fallujah, people whose families lived there. And one guy was saying his brother had been killed, his brother's son, his sister's son, and his best friend had been killed that morning, wounded in the leg in the fighting. And the soldiers, American soldiers, came right up to him and cut his throat. You know, there's uproar if it's filmed by NBC, but most of the time it isn't. And it goes on a lot. You know, we were always hearing those stories from people. But Lee and Ahra, who were with us, had seen the body come into the clinic that we were working from. So, I mean, people had just lost so much.
What were your feelings about the fighters? Because you yourself were kidnapped at one stage as well, weren't you?
Well, I mean, they took us prisoner as a security thing more than anything else, because there were all these disparate groups. There wasn't like a single Mujahideen command that was in control of all the other groups or of all the cells or whatever. It was just people, a street full of people fighting in one place and another street full of people in another place. So they didn't all know who we were. And as we were leaving, the Americans were firing warning shots over our car. And so that drew the fighters out of the houses behind us. They were firing back. We were kind of underneath the crossfire. And then one of the fighters jumped in the car and kind of directed us around the corner. And then we were held for about 18 hours and handed over to a local imam and driven back to Baghdad. But, I mean, they told us late the night before that they were going to release us, they were going to take us back. And obviously you don't quite believe that until you are safely back in Baghdad, but they'd fed us. Jenny got sick, and they brought her one of those fizzing tablet things to settle her stomach. And I mean, they were kind to us after everything that they'd suffered at the hands of Britain and America. And we were two British, one Australian, one American, and then another British journalist, a Palestinian guy and an Iraqi woman with us. They weren't violent with us at any point, but once they knew that we'd been driving, you know, doing ambulance work, they were just completely okay with us.
And you've had very close friends killed there, haven't you? It must be very difficult when that happens.
Well, it is, but again, it's nothing compared with what the Iraqis go through. I mean, my family are not over there. My family are here, and they're safe, and I don't have to worry about every time they go out of the house whether they're going to come home again. I mean, it's far, far more difficult for people in Iraq where they've got, I mean, remember during the war, whenever there was a bomb and you thought that was the direction where one of your friends lived, you'd be, you know, frantically trying to call them until you'd tracked them down and you managed to speak to them. And that was for me, having been there for a few weeks. For Iraqi people who have got friends and networks of family across the entire city and country, it's just unbearable without adequate phone lines, without a postal system, without any way some of the time of finding out where people are. And most Iraqi people can't afford a mobile phone. It was a lot easier for us because once the mobile phones existed, we could afford to buy them. So, you know, really what we went through was just barely anything in comparison. And we could leave at any time. Most of the Iraqis don't have that opportunity to just go somewhere else, even just for a bit of respite.
When I first went to Iraq, I was opposed to the war. I didn't agree with the politics behind it. I didn't believe in the claims of weapons of mass destruction. I thought the idea of preemptive war was a horrible idea. But I still went over because my friends were going over there, and I felt I had an obligation to protect them and make sure they came home alive, just like they would do the same for me.
What was your experience like when you got to Iraq?
It's really hard to sum up. It's basically something I don't want anyone else to ever have to deal with. It's just basically you're put in a situation where you're forced to make decisions and do things that no human being should ever have to do.
When you originally signed up for the military, did you anticipate that would be your feelings?
Well, yeah, I basically did. I knew I could go to war, and I accepted that. But at the same time, I believed that if I did go to war, it would be because we had to go. I felt that when the U.S. got involved in things when I first joined the military, it was involved because they had to, because they were trying to protect lives or defend our country. And going to Iraq, I learned that to be false.
You said that it's like also supporting a family, going with your fellow colleagues.
It is. When you're in the military, the people you serve with, you live with them. You live with them. You eat with them. You all sleep in the same building. You're together constantly, and they become family. You spend years with these people, and you care about them just like you would a family. And it's one thing they really rely on is that you won't abandon them, and that's why people go to combat, is that you can't abandon people like that.
How did you come into contact with the civilian face of Iraq?
When I was over there, we didn't deal with civilians that much. It was kind of this very hands-off thing. They didn't talk to us. They left us alone, and we did the same. They were scared of us, and I don't blame them, because when ripping through that country, I mean, we absolutely decimated it.
When you were serving in Iraq, was there a turning point for you?
I think that the one thing that really, when I really realized what we had done and what had gone on there was after we had just left Iraq, we were in Kuwait waiting to go back to the States, and somebody made a statement saying, I just don't know why the people of Iraq didn't just rise up and take care of them themselves. And it upset me because he didn't understand what was going on there. He didn't understand the climate of fear, and it just wasn't that simple. And I said that to him, I kind of thought to myself, well, what have I been thinking the past couple of months? You know, the state of mind I'm in right now wasn't where I was while I was in Iraq fighting. It was just a completely different mindset. And that's when I realized what I was doing in there and what I realized I had been capable of doing while I was there.
And what got you motivated to found Iraqi Veterans Against the War?
It's the idea that I'm home now. I can speak my mind. I've been discharged. And there's so many in the military right now who can't do that. They're still stuck in there, and they can't speak for themselves because they feel trapped and they're afraid. And in order to bring them home and end this conflict and save lives, the truth has to be told, and I'm in the situation to do it right now. I have to speak for all those who can't speak for themselves.
How much truth do you think the American public can actually see?
Very, very little. What the media is telling us in America is, it's not that they're lying to us, it's just they're not telling us everything. They're missing what's happening on the ground. They're missing the personal stories. They talk about huge numbers, like 1,500 total coalition casualties and 100,000 dead Iraqi civilians. But it's hard to really understand it when you give terms like that. You have to understand the personal stories. You have to, hear stories like Jimmy Massey, who will tell you point blank about how he and the rest of his platoon opened fire on an unarmed civilian demonstration, how Rob Serra had to watch one of his Marines bleed to death in front of him because he didn't have the proper body armor, how I remember driving up the road to Baghdad and getting smelling this horrible stench and then realizing what it was when we saw there were a series of Iraqi vehicles that were on fire, and we looked and saw that the hatches were still closed, meaning the people that are still inside those vehicles burning to death. That's what they're not hearing. They're not hearing these personal stories that really tell people horror of war, that war is such a horrible, terrible thing, because all they see on CNN is and other news channels are these clean images of guided missiles shooting down air ducts. That's not war. Tim O'Brien said it best, war is horror, war is evil, and people need to understand that. You should never, ever feel good about war.
Because I guess you're taught and trained to be immune to that, but when does there come a point when those feelings really do get to you?
No matter how much training you receive, you're never prepared for what really happens in war. Everybody has a breaking point. I remember talking to my battery first sergeant who had served in the first Gulf War, And he told me a story of how he was walking down the street with, he was a platoon sergeant with the, with his platoon, and the point man, that's the person who walks out front. He said it was a very good Marine, experienced, you know, you could always rely on him, suddenly just broke down. He just started screaming and crying, and, you know, he took him and put him in the back, and he said he just broke. He had been up front the whole time, and just the stress from, you know, the casualties and seeing, you know, people killed and walking down these streets not knowing if there's a landmine or something like that in front of him just finally broke him. You can never prepare someone for something like this. And like I said, they have a breaking point and they'll break eventually, be it while they're over there or after they come home, they'll break.
And on a personal level, do you regret the choice of going into the military?
I don't believe in really looking back and regret of decisions you made, because you'll end up driving yourself insane. I think the best way to put it is just one of my friend's wives, my friend's a Vietnam veteran, so she's dealt with, you know, the issues of Vietnam and things like that, and she told me that she's sorry I went through what I've done, and she's sorry that I've seen the things I've done, but she's glad it was me, because, you know, I'm able to come back and talk about these things and help end this.